This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We depend utterly on fossil fuels, especially to grow our food. From natural gas comes the millions of tons of fertilizers. Oil provides herbicides and pesticides. All is planted and harvested with oil power, driven, shipped, and flown to your table. For now. Until fossil fuels become too expensive, too rare, or too polluting to use, we have only a short time to find other ways. Wes Jackson offers some good answers for our food supply during peak oil and climate change. Raised on a Kansas farm, Jackson is a biologist, a geneticist, and a botanist. In 1976, he left university life to found the Land Institute, which he still heads. He's going to explain natural systems agriculture in a powerful speech given to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, USA. Then we'll hear a different assessment of the potential for sequestering carbon in the soil and biochar from the Australian carbon cycle expert Dr. Michael Ropak. This Radio EcoShock program is part of our Big Picture series of solutions. I'm Alex Smith. Let's begin with Wes Jackson, recorded November 4, 2011, in Washington, D.C., for Radio EcoShock by Jerry Williams.
Well, thank you. What a pleasure to be here. I want to first of all tell you what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about biofuels, considering that the average American in calories consumes the equivalent of about 26 gallons of gasoline a year. Let's say we don't eat for a year and turn all of our food into ethanol. That's 2 gallons a month per person. That's for the trucks over the road, airplanes, the postal workers, whatever. If we take all the wheat straw, corn stalks, peanut shells, grass clippings, maybe another 2 gallons a month. And depending on how you calculate it, stop all exports, and there's another 1.5 to 2 gallons a month. I'm not going to talk about biofuels. Nor am I going to talk about what peak oil means. A few years ago, I was getting ready to give a commencement address to some graduates of a college, and they were surprised, you folks wouldn't be, that the 10-year-old has lived through a quarter of all the oil ever burned. The 22-year-old, 54% of all the oil ever burned. You folks know that, so I'm not going to talk about that. I am going to tell you, though, some of you may not know this, that soil is more important than oil. And as much of a non-renewable resource as oil. Soil is the product of geologic activity. There's a very good reason why Australia is a poor continent and is going to stay poor. Its last geologic activity was 65 million years ago. We have mountains that lift up, and we are the most fortunate nation of all because of the Pleistocene, the ice that gouged the nutrients off the Canadian Shield, and fortunate that it parked it through that 1.8 or 9 million year period north of the Gulf of Mexico so that we get the water at the right time, the nutrients. This was not paid attention to when Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States in 1959 and visited the Iowa cornfields and was wondering what they're doing in Iowa to have those kinds of yields. Well, we had a good Pleistocene, and we happened to be north of the Gulf of Mexico. So the day will come in which we will quit treating soil like dirt. The day will come in which we will recognize what the most important invention of the 20th century was. In 1909, two Germans learned how to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into ammonia. Fritz Haber and Carl Bosch, Vaclav Smil, the nitrogen scholar who's written on it extensively for decades, reckons that if we did not have Haber-Bosch, essentially all of it fueled by natural gas as the feedstock, 40% of humanity wouldn't be here now. So here we are at 7 billion and counting. And I have to say, my friends, that soil is too often overlooked as being as much in danger and as much a problem for our future as oil. It's pretty hard to convince us in our time constantly looking at peak oil, which we should. But essentially my message is this. If we can keep ourselves fed through this long, dark tunnel that we're going to be going through as we try to get in control of our appetite for fossil carbon, if we can keep our soils in place, all of the gains that we have had at the beginning of what I call the fall, the biblical fall, if you wish, at least that myth, of 10,000 years ago when we started agriculture and got at the young pulverized coal of the soil, the carbon of the soil that made civilization possible, and then 5,000 years ago, the forests that made possible to smelt the ore for the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and then, of course, the coal 250 years ago, Drake's oil well 1859, natural gas used for power a little after that. And I'm going to show you slides. And then I hope at the end I will convince you of the necessity and the possibility of a sustainable green revolution. And I think it passes the test that it's not grandiose. Here is, as I see it, an important chronology. I start with what I call the 3.45 billion year imperative. All organisms are made of carbon, and we go after energy-rich carbon. If it's bacteria on a petri dish, Drosophila flies in a flask on mashed up banana and yeast, or deer, you know, deer without predators. That's what we do, the 3.45 billion year imperative. Well, 10,000 years ago, we got into the first pool of energy-rich carbon that we began to use at a rate that was faster than the rate of renewal. It's been estimated that the continent had about 6% carbon in our soils. They're now down to about 3%. That was, in my view, the beginning of climate change, the soil carbon. The second pool I already mentioned, 5,000 years ago, the forests. Then I'm going to move on down the Industrial Revolution, the third pool, Drake's oil well, the fourth, and then natural gas. But now move over. In 1492, something else happened, and that was the opening up of land with Columbus. In 1803, the Louisiana Purchase, and then in 1862, the Homestead Act. In around 1600, something important happened, the Copernican Revolution, which paved the way for the scientific era, the likes of Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and that's where the knowledge is adequate worldview came to be. Bill Vitek and I edited a book on the virtues of ignorance. And it was predicated on the idea that we assume that knowledge is adequate to run the world, but we all know we're billions of times more ignorant than knowledgeable and always will be. And so we're arguing the need for us to go with our long suit. Let's have an ignorance-based worldview. And if we do, that will be a whole different way of thinking about how we go about the world. Out of that knowledge is adequate worldview, we have created a lot of problems. So I'm here today to talk to you about ignorance and how ignorance can help us into the possibility of a sunshine future. And then I'll talk a little more about the institutions that have come along that can help. All right, in May of 1862, Congress passed the Homestead Act, and so now the land is available for people if they just go out and prove up on it. It's interesting that as soon as July, we put in the Land-Grant College Act, the Morrill Act, and this established the land-grant colleges devoted to the mechanic arts and agriculture. In 1887, the Hatch Act is the coming of the experiment station. And then in 1914, we have the Smith-Lever Act, which is the extension service. So there it is. We're on a new continent, and Dan Luton, a friend of mine at Berkeley, is dead now, in 1969, wrote something like this. We came as a poor people to a seemingly empty land that was rich in resources, and we built our institutions for that perception of reality. Our educational institutions, our economic institutions, our political institutions, all predicated on poor people, empty land that's rich. Now we've become rich people in an increasingly poor land that's filling up, and those institutions don't hold. We patch them up, we give them a lick and a promise, but they don't hold. And that's part of our modern challenge. The Louisiana Purchase in 1803 was a territory that they could flood into. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was 1854. A week or so before that act, for the ratification of that, my own great-grandfather came into Kansas and took up land, had to be moved for a little bit because he is settled on Indian land. But imagine that huge expanse of land that's lying out there beckoning like a liberation. And so what do? Given our 3.45 billion year imperative, given the fact that we're land animals, given that we want to harvest contemporary sunlight as our food, we pour into that landscape and appropriate it and convert it into agriculture crops where appropriate. Well, that is a part of the mentality that came with us and is part of the mentality that I think we're all questioning today. In 1948, this is Norman Rockwell's county agent, it all had come together. The land-grant college, experiment station and extension, and here is the land. This happens to be in Indiana. There is Dad back in the shadows with a cat on his shoulder. There is the horse still in the barn. There's Grandpa looking in. There's the dutiful 4-H girl measuring the girth of a Guernsey, looking on as the county agent measures the girth of a Guernsey heifer. There's Brother with his poultry project. And there is Sis with her sewing project. And Mom looking on proudly. Well, what do you see in that photo, in that painting? I think Rockwell was only painting what was, but he also was painting what got writ large. Expertise and youth are central in that painting. Tradition and experience are peripheral. And therein lies a tale that I think we can all imagine. Well, I learned the name of that county agent, and I called anybody in the phone book by the name of Ripley in that town in Indiana, and I got a man, I think he was in real estate. I said, can you tell me about the family? Sure, he says. He gave me the name of the kids. Can you give me the number? He gave me the number of Gamma Sue. I called Gamma Sue, the one that's holding the 4-H record book. Are you on the farm? No. When did you leave the farm? 18. What about your sister? She left too. What about brother? Well, brother died during the farm crisis of the 80s. Dad had been killed by the bull. Anybody of your family on the land? No, we ran it out. This happened all over agricultural America. So one has to ask why. Let's go back to 1948. The global pesticide production really began about that time, and sales followed. In spite of Silent Spring, 1962, the pesticide industry has doubled, had doubled, and doubled again. Nitrogen, going back to about that time, in spite of Haber-Bosch, in 1909, remember, we had World War I. We had a depression. Then we had World War II. Finally, we get it together and start the takeoff. So nitrogen, more irrigation wells get put down, phosphorus, and so on. And, of course, there is the diesel fuel that made it possible to ship the horses off the farm to become dog food. And here is the anhydrous ammonia tanks that replaced the recycling of the manure. And also about that time, the farm sales accelerate. Here is an auction. And the loft of that barn is the fuel tank. The bottom of that barn is where the straw would be mixed with the manure and urine. But look what happens when you no longer need that fuel tank and you no longer need a place to manage the urine and the manure. The barns go down. And the only reason those barns stay now, whatever ones stay, it's due to nostalgia, primarily nostalgia. This is a microscope slide with algae cells, photosynthesizers, and then there are the concentrators, the tube animals. Now, move down to the next slide. That's looking down on the canopy of a tropical rainforest. And there you see the canopy as the photosynthesizers, and the trunks and limbs are the concentrators. And then move on down. This is looking down on Kansas in the 1930s. And here, this is a 3-mile stretch. But there are the fields that are the photosynthesizers, and then the farmsteads and the villages are the concentrators. You reduce all three of these to a common scale, and the radial arms going out from the concentrators to the concentrate-e are about the same. Well, then what happens when you introduce fossil fuel into your system? Highly dense energy brought into your system, the farm, how farms start getting sold. So I think there is a general law, High energy destroys information of the cultural and biological varieties. So Norman Rockwell's canny agent, that cultural capacity for growing food on contemporary sunlight is mostly gone. We will get the horses back faster than we'll get the people that have the know-how to farm using the contemporary energy. This, to me, is the primary food crisis.
You are listening to Dr. Wes Jackson as he develops a deep theory for the reform of agriculture to survive the twin challenges of peak oil and climate change. The natural farmers, he says, are gone with their knowledge of living in immediate time. They are replaced by carbon-powered food production, a short-term phenomenon. Jackson, founder of the Land Institute, has a deep solution to revolutionize agriculture. This is Radio EcoShock.
This is not true for everybody, but by and large, you have to be raised to farming. Well, let's just draw a deep breath for a moment. Put that behind and allow it to creep up in your minds a little bit now and then from time to time. And let's think about the last green revolution and what those assumptions were. There were about five of them. My friend Angus Wright, who wrote that marvelous book, The Death of Ramon Gonzalez, The Modern Agricultural Dilemma. This is sort of Angus's summary. And he has studied the Green Revolution particularly in Latin America. Here was the assumption: low productivity is the problem. We need higher yields per acre. Now, soil degradation was factored in, but as a cost, in the emphasis in there on input-output ratio. The gap between the social reality and the scientific challenge was more or less ignored by the big players. The Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, and so on. A second assumption: traditional techniques by countless farmers were considered more of an obstacle than a resource. These people need to get modern. The third: technologies are neutral. When persuasion fails, it's time to use compulsion. Four: agriculture is to serve as an instrument for the advancement of industry. So adoption of the Green Revolution package is essential. Need more chemicals? Build a chemical plant for fertilizer, pesticides. And finally, agriculture is not vitally linked to wild nature, and that'll become a point of departure later on in this talk. So here's been the number one killer of our continent, the corn plant. The yields now, well over 200 bushels per acre. When I was born 75 years ago, it was around 30 bushels per acre. This plant, though, has taken over as probably the number one killer. That's soybeans. Corn went from 70 million acres in 1 year to 90 million acres as a result of the subsidies on ethanol. The ethanol subsidies right at $6 billion this year. Soil erosion has gone up, but we haven't got the estimates in on that yet. But if you look at the Corn Belt, Minnesota up there at the top, Wisconsin, that is really brown, is soil that's exposed in April, right when the rains are coming. That which is yellow is because of averaging these colors. And all of those states do have soil erosion. It's just that the brown shows it up more because it's almost 100% there. That's corn and soybeans. And this is not a rare scene. This happens to be in Illinois. And notice that the corn is barely up. So there it is in Iowa. Well, is this just the problem in the United States? No, this is in Ethiopia. And this is in a Green Revolution area. That whole field was once wheat, but it wasn't wheat for very long. The original vegetative structure had been disturbed. Well, we are humans. We humans are clever. We will invent minimum till, no till. We will use pesticides to kill off the weeds. Then we will drill right into the stubble. And sure enough, the conventional there is milky water there at the lower part of the picture. That, though, that is minimum till, no till, is nice and clear. That's wonderful, except for one thing. The nitrogen level in that water is twice the acceptable level of the Environmental Protection Agency. So what's wrong? And, of course, half the nitrogen applied on the upper Midwest ends up to help make a dead zone, which is now about as large as New Jersey. And it disrupts the fisheries, of course. So here's the 3.45 billion year imperative. We go after energy-rich carbon to either eat, and we also, in an exogenous sort of way. Here are the five pools that we have gone through in our journey since the break with nature, merely some 400 or 500 generations ago. It's interesting that there's always been an acknowledgement of nature having practical value. In the formal culture, namely the literary and the scientific tradition, it comes as a series. For instance, Wendell Berry went through the history of this, going all the way back to Job, and Virgil And then in the literary tradition, in English literature, you can see it in Shakespeare, in Spenser, in Milton, and finally in Alexander Pope. Alexander Pope's poem, The Epistle to Burlington, says this: "Let nature never be forgot, consult the genius of the place in all." A-L-L. So the genius of the place in Kansas is the prairie. The genius of the place in the tropical rainforest is the rainforest. The genius of the prairie, that ecosystem, is able to receive precipitation. And during the great Dust Bowl years of the 30s, the prairie lived, the wheat plants died. On the other hand, the genius of the place in the tropics, that system is designed to get rid of water fast using giant engines, like giant engines, pushing that water back into the atmosphere. And so two different ecosystems, we plant soybeans in both places. So Homo the homogenizer has been around for some 10,000 years. And in the formal culture, after Pope, after Alexander Pope, the idea of nature having practical value went underground, and when it surfaced, it was around 1900 with Liberty Hyde Bailey. After that, Sir Albert Howard and J. Russell Smith, his book on tree crops. So we have that. Wendell says that comes as a series. It just pops up. But, he says, in the common culture, it's a succession. In other words, it's like a stream carried along, but then in the formal culture, it pops up as a series. Now, 1935, Hugh Hammond Bennett, the founding chief of the Soil Conservation Service under Roosevelt, there was our first opportunity to move the idea of nature as measure into the formal culture. And so never has an organization been put together with more esprit de corps devoted to the common task of saving our soils. It was energetic, lots of imagination, total support. Roosevelt called in Hugh Hammond Bennett one time. He says, "Bennett, you give me more trouble than anybody in my administration. Bennett, I get calls about you. I get people complaining. Keep up the good work, Bennett." So here is a tropical rainforest, a perennial mixture or polyculture. Here is desert scrub, a perennial mixture or polyculture. Here is one of our typical scenes in Kansas, tall grass prairie, a perennial polyculture. So what happened 10,000 years ago? At the eastern end of the Mediterranean, it's drying out. The ice is receding. And over in the Zagros Mountains of western Iran, a species, the wheat plant, they started cultivating it. And that was an annual, not a perennial, grown in monocultures. In order for that seed to be able to germinate, nature had to be subdued or ignored. So, 70% of our calories come from grains. Number one crop is rice. It's number two in acreage. This is of the planet now. Number two crop is wheat. It's number one in acreage. Number three is corn. Then we have potato, but after that it's the grains again. Humans are primarily grass seed eaters. And secondarily, legume seed eaters. 70% of our calories from roughly 67-68% of the agricultural acreage devoted to annual monocultures. And in order to do that, this idea that nature's to be subdued or ignored has ricocheted through civilization at many levels and even informs the technological fundamentalism that's rampant in our world today. So, starting in 1977, looking at It looked to me like reading the General Accounting Office report that soil erosion was as bad in 77 as when the Soil Conservation Service was formed in the 30s. And after taking my students on a field trip to the Kansa Prairie and noting the soil erosion all around me, I wondered, why can't we build an agriculture based on perennial grains grown in mixtures and take advantage of the efficiencies that are inherent within those natural integrities? And so we're mostly plant breeders at the Land Institute, and we have some bright young PhDs that learned a lot more than I did in graduate school in genetics. They got so many more techniques available to them. And so among the things we're doing is crossing wheat with wild relatives. We get hybrids. We do most of this hybridization in the greenhouse at the land. We have a total of 31 staff, 39 in the summertime. So we've got quite a few hands at work. We do what's called chromosome painting if necessary. And the one color of chromosome came from one species, the other color from another. That'll tell us what kind of a chromosomal balance we have. We use molecular markers. By the way, this is to impress you, not inform you. And sometimes we make a hybrid, and when we do, it'll form an embryo, but not the endosperm. And so we rescue the embryo and put it on a gel. Then we can get this hybrid that we can then back cross in either direction and often, usually, reestablish the endosperm. So we rescue more embryos than anybody in the state of Kansas. We're pro-life at the Land Institute. And here represent some of our hybrids that you see. They've been harvested, and here they are shooting up. So we say, okay, that's something we want to look at more carefully. But notice how many of them out there did not send up shoots. Of almost 2,000 plants, 43% survived the summer of 10. So we're selecting pretty rigorously for those that can make it. And we've got germplasm in Australia, several countries around the world. These are some plots of Cicero in New South Wales. Those are some of our plants. In Nepal. And then here is just a field trial of some of our what we call Kernza. We name it's Phenopyrum intermedium. We gave it the name Kernza, Kansas, Kansa Indians, Kernel, and anything with a Z in it is more memorable.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with Dr. Wes Jackson, answering the challenge of feeding the world with declining fossil fuel resources in a climate-changed world.
The plant on your right is the species that started civilization. And imagine the vegetative structure that had to be destroyed below ground as well as above ground that then opened our landscapes to soil erosion. The plant on the left is our Kernza. And here's some flower. So it'll be about 9 or 10 years before that's farmer ready. When I first published on this in 78, I said, this is 50 to 100 years. Well, we're on schedule. At that time, folks were saying, my golly, that's too long. Can we wait around that long? But now with climate change, the population problem, we're suddenly in the short solution category. Our motto at the land has been, if you're working on something you can finish in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. I think that's something we all got to think about really hard. As far as this ever becomes being fulfilled, I'll be good on the harp. Well, there you can see the contrast. Imagine in September on the left now, we plant the wheat. You can't even see the grain. December, the wheat plants a little bit along. March, it's along. By June, it still doesn't get to be as long as the Kernza. So imagine when we came across this continent, cutting the forests and plowing the prairies. Imagine as we went through plowing that prairie, they said it sounded like the opening of a zipper. Imagine what we were destroying. That, in my view, is the carbon that is more important in the soil than in the gas tank. And that's some of the carbon that would be translocated to the gas tank. Wendell Berry says, as we came across the continent, cutting the forests, plowing the prairies, we've never known what we were doing because we've never known what we were undoing. We were undoing an original relationship with the planet, millions and millions of years old ecosystem, and now we need to perennialize corn. This is some of our work with the sorghum, and we now have winter hardy perennial sorghum. Still a lot of breeding to do, though. Also, sunflowers, very important oilseed crop. Makes the top 20. It's amazing. Here you can see we already have the big head on one of our perennials. And working with another closely related species. Here we are also, two of our guys are right now in China. We're supporting the perennialization of the upland rice. Stan Cox and Lee Di Han. This is something that's developed in those areas in the uplands where they have that upland rice where they'll destroy the original vegetative structure, maybe get a crop for a couple of years, and then that's it. So here is in Yunnan province some of the rices. Okay, so we could go on and on about our breeding work. If we can keep ourselves fed, agriculture is the number one threat to wild biodiversity. But given the desecration of our ag lands worldwide and our dependency on fossil fuels, what do? We can introduce the ecosystem concept. Think of it this way, folks. For 10,000 years, we have not been able to use the ecosystem concept because tearing the ground up every year, the ecological processes don't have a chance. It's like clear cutting. But now, with the perennials on the horizon, we can begin to imagine. Here's the story. Darwin gave us the unification of biology. Darwin is the most important biologist since Aristotle. He brought together biologists in anatomy, morphology, all sorts of things, and it came right out of a natural history tradition. Darwin is 1859, the same year as Drake's oil well, the same year that John Brown is hanged at Harper's Ferry. That's another connection. There's another lecture there. Darwin, without soil carbon, forest carbon, and coal, we'd have never had him. John Brown was able to get traction in the North about overcoming slavery because the North was becoming more industrialized and the agrarian South wasn't. And he overstepped in taking the arsenal. And they hanged him in the same month that The Origin of Species comes out. I promise you I won't go any more about that. But it's wonderfully interesting about 1859. And what was happening then. Because a little over 100 years before that is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And also remember it's like 1865 that we have the coal question written. You all know about the coal question? Jevons' paradox. He found that as industrial England got more efficient with its technology, industrial England used more resources, particularly coal and iron. And that's something we need to come to, well, it frees up capital, but something we need to come to grips with. So, now another long breath. Am I all right? Just a little bit?
4 minutes.
4 minutes? Oh, my God. Here is the hierarchy of structure. Atoms, molecules, cells, tissues, organs, organisms, ecosystem, ecosphere. Since around 1600, we've increasingly looked downward in a more reductive approach to solve our problems. And right now, we have two molecules that we're using to deal with the soil erosion problem. The molecule of Roundup Ready and the molecule for resistance to Roundup. But we're saying upward in that hierarchy, being put on the shelf over 100 years, and especially since 1980, the long-term ecological research sites, 26 of them around the country, ecologists have been putting on the shelf for its own sake because they have the luxury to be descriptive, while the agriculturists have had the burden to be prescriptive. We have not been able to bring all that body of knowledge to inform a research agenda for agriculture. And so, does this idea have legs? Yes, a conference in Australia, agriculture is a mimic of natural ecosystems. And so, three of us took to the U.S. Department of Agriculture what we call the 50-year farm bill. And we said, look, for $50 million a year, spread over 50 years, we can build an agriculture, and that will be a conceptual revolution more important than the Copernican revolution, which we didn't need when we got it. It's all right now. But so what? We still say the sun's coming up. We don't seem to get it. So the 50-year farm bill, though, would be saving the soil resources and the water resources and eliminate the toxics. And here's what it looked like. Here's the 328 million acres of agricultural land in the U.S., and 80% of it is annuals, 20% perennials. So we're wanting to use the 5-year farm bills as mileposts to get that reversed over a 50-year period. So the brown part, those are the vegetables and the fruits, the things that make up the sustainable ag movement. They're only around 4% of our total land. But then the yellow are the grains, and then the green are the pastures that may be in a rotation, some perennials in rotation. So where the blue kicks in is when our perennials become ready. And then where it's hatched on the blue, that is, those will also be grazed. So I'm going to move because I'm out of time. Yeah, oh, all right. How do we manage this? Fire, grazing. These are our 30 head of bison on our 160 acres of prairie. That's our standard. If we want to know what to do, we go to find out what the prairie is doing. So here is the domestic bovine. Here, and by the way, that domestic bovine is a selective grazer. And the management of these perennial polyculture grain crops in the future will require some selective grazing, but they will also require the non-selective grazer. This is where the biofuels ought to be used and nowhere else. So the next synthesis, Darwin gave us the first synthesis. Dobzhansky in 1937 wrote the book Genetics and the Origin of Species. We didn't have a good theory of heredity. Darwin didn't. But now, after there's been a synthesis, there's been a flowering. And then the next was 1953, Watson and Crick and the molecular. Genetics, evolution with the modern molecular synthesis. Now we have that tremendous body of knowledge available to go to work. So what we're calling for is the foundation world over a 30-year period to spend $1.64 billion educating 110 PhD-level scientists that would be positioned around the world to bring on a sustainable green revolution. Each one of them would have a technician, each would have support staff, and they are to be mission-oriented and to not be detracted by the here and now. But yes, let the here and now folk interact, and there will be interaction both ways and again, but by and large, keep it straight that this is mission-oriented research for a planet whose food-producing system is in decline. So, just be quiet a minute. we can have production as a consequence, conservation as a consequence of production. We can build this agriculture that is more like a natural ecosystem than we've been able to do until now. We have these graduate fellows that want to go, but where are they going to find jobs in a society in which the institutions are the product of poor people coming from a poor people, rich land, lots of resources? We've got those institutional barriers that are the same ones about getting us off fossil fuels. So that's it.
That was Dr. Wes Jackson, founder of the Land Institute at landinstitute.org. The speech was recorded in Washington, D.C. at the ASPL USA Conference, November 4, 2011, by Jerry Williams of Radio EcoShock. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil for this presentation.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Hi there, listeners in Radioland. Tonight you're in for a special occasion.
Lately on Radio EcoShock, we've talked about sequestering carbon back into the soil using different farming techniques. I checked with my longtime email correspondent and super paleoclimatologist from Australia, Dr. Andrew Glickson. Andrew said, you have to ask Dr. Michael Ropak. He's the best on carbon cycles. We have Michael Ropak on the line from Adelaide. He's the longtime science leader, researcher, and fellow of CSIRO. That is the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. It is Australia's National Science Agency. Dr. Ropak, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure, Alex.
Michael Ropak, I called about the carbon cycle and the proposals to take more carbon into the soil with better farming. What methods have you heard about, and is this a serious possibility to help solve the climate crisis?
That's a very good question. Before we come to the issue of what methods, let's just talk about soil carbon and its potential role as a sink. The first thing we have to recognize is that there's a huge amount of carbon in the world's soils, something like three times the total amount that there is in the atmosphere. So you would think on that basis that there's a possibility to just slightly increase that amount, the total amount of carbon in the world's soils, and lo and behold, we've extracted a huge amount from the atmosphere in order to do that. It's not actually that simple, because there's, in reality, a continual exchange of carbon between soils and the atmosphere. If left to themselves, soil carbon in any given system, be it a forest or a grassland or an agricultural system, will reach a natural level which is in a kind of equilibrium with the other ecosystem processes or the management processes that are happening on that land. So when we talk about increasing soil carbon, we're talking about somehow changing those processes that determine that equilibrium in a way that will tip the equilibrium, not just for a few years, but essentially forever. Because if we reverse that change in the processes that are altering the equilibrium and allow them to go back to what they were before, all the carbon comes straight back out again and we go back to where we were before. So...
Well, the proponents suggest that the development of modern agriculture and exposing soils and plowing it and so on have really lessened not only the amount of soil that we have, but also the nutrients and the carbon in that soil. So they're thinking if we could, well, first of all, they're saying there's been a general loss of carbon in the soils over the ages since agriculture was developed. Do we have science to back that up?
To some extent, we do. There are studies which demonstrate that in some systems, changing practices from, for instance, land clearing in order to take away forests and introduce agriculture has decreased the total amount of carbon in the landscape. Some of that's the loss of carbon in wood from the trees as they decay or are burned or whatever, and that carbon ends up in the atmosphere. Some of it's soil carbon. Studies, however, are a bit, they go both ways. There are some studies which suggest that the total soil carbon content in forests is not all that different from the soil carbon content in well-maintained agricultural systems which have been set up as the landscape is cleared. Now, certainly in many semi-arid environments, if the agricultural systems are not good and if the land is allowed to seriously degrade, then most certainly there's a significant loss of soil carbon and nutrients. That the nutrients, of course, go with soil carbon. That's another part of the puzzle that we have to think about carefully. But the overall story is that there has been a loss of carbon from forests as they're cleared to go to grassland. Much of that loss is associated with the wood. The component that's associated with the soil can go both ways. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes negative, depending on the exact details of the change.
And I think one of the other acknowledged weaknesses of the agricultural method is the requirement to change age-old habits in millions of farmers, plus the new industrialized methods of profit-making corporations. The communications and training problems are immense, and I'm wondering whether that disqualifies this as a solution to averting the worst of climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Now, the question of sequestering carbon in landscapes, and in my view, that's a much more uncertain story. The extent to which carbon can be sequestered and can be done in ways that make it trackable and accountable and capable of being measured, that's much more difficult. But I think that committing to major changes in soil carbon across the world as a significant sequestration strategy in order to bring emissions under control is fraught with danger.
But NASA's James Hansen has suggested biochar might work. What are your thoughts on biochar?
Well, a study published in Nature a couple of years ago suggested that biochar, at the very most, could contribute a mitigation potential of about 10% of what's required. In other words, that over the next, let's say, 50 years, the largest conceivable biochar program would contribute something like 10%, what's sometimes called a wedge of 10% of the emissions mitigation needs to be brought about by then. Now, 10% is significant, but we have to look at the costs that are that may be associated with that. And biochar as a strategy involves the large-scale diversion of wastes, of agricultural and forest production wastes, into plants which can be factories, essentially, which convert this into a combination of gas which has some energy potential and char which can be put back onto landscapes. The costs of doing this need to be weighed up against the benefits, and those costs include potential diversions of agricultural and other forms of land to service a biochar industry, potentially reducing their ability to produce food. And of course, food is, along with mitigating climate change, producing food is a major requirement. It's something that's indispensable over the coming decades. So we need to be careful both about the magnitude of a biochar industry and the possible side effects of it. I think there has been some tendency in the last few years to see biochar as a magic cure. In this game, there are no magic cures. And anybody who says, oh, we can fix this with biochar, and in my own country, there are a number of people who are making claims of that sort. Those claims simply don't stack up against the reality.
And I can see another hurdle, and that's the changes in the hydrological cycle. As the world warms, we have projections showing desertification over some of the world's subtropical regions, and Australia has suffered terribly in its agriculture. Maybe it's too late to try agricultural sequestration in some areas.
Well, I think agricultural sequestration, in essence, is a side benefit of other changes that we're going to need to make in production systems. And it may be a side cost in some circumstances. So I really think we should take agricultural sequestration largely out of the equation in terms of our long-term thinking about emissions mitigation. The way we should be reducing our emissions is through reducing the use of carbon-based fossil fuels for energy. We should be conserving. We should be doing all of these actions which are necessary in order to bring this curve of emissions that have been increasing at 3% per year over the last decade back down to steady, and then in a very few years to reducing at something like 3% per year. Those steps require us to address the fossil fuel-based side of this entire picture. And I feel that a stress on sequestration as a mitigation potential for mitigation reasons is diverting an enormous amount of energy from that central task.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Michael Ropak from Australia's National Science Agency, CSIRO. We're talking about places Earth could store our excess carbon dioxide.
I think the overwhelming message, if we return to the question of soil carbon, is that of balance. At the moment, we have an Earth system which is significantly unbalanced from the point of view of the planet. The major unbalance is occurring because of emissions of fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases into the Earth system. Our challenge over the coming century is to get things back into balance. And how we do that is largely going to be by reducing the forces, the drivers that have sent things out of balance, rather than by attempting to put compensations back into the system. So one big example of an attempt to restore balance in some sense by compensating somewhere else would be geoengineering. I think geoengineering, from almost every point of view, is not a good idea. We don't know enough about the system we're trying to engineer. It would have enormous disbenefits, enormous costs, as well as the benefits that it's supposed to be having. It would commit us, as a human species, to effectively steering the Earth system, which we don't properly understand, to achieve some sort of balance, which is a long way away from the one to which the Earth system would tend naturally if left to itself from the point of view of climate, CO2 and so on. This, I think, is enormously dangerous. And given how much we don't understand about the Earth system, given the fact that we know that climate varies enormously, you know, we look back over hundreds of thousands of years and we see the massive changes in climate that have occurred through the ice ages, we don't understand enough about the system to be confident that we can control it and have it avoid running off the rails in some sense that would be catastrophic for humanity. A very famous climatologist said once that people used to have the view that climate is a benign and trustworthy state of affairs for the world. The view, as we look back over those hundreds of thousands of years, is that climate, in fact, tends to be something like an angry beast, and if provoked, can lash back in all kinds of unexpected ways. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why we should be very hesitant about trying to manage the climate system with geoengineering strategies, which would have us locked into, in one sense, managing this angry beast.
We have been talking with Dr. Michael Ropak, researcher and fellow of CSIRO, the Australian National Science Agency. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your time and this insight.
Pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. And don't forget our program from November 30th, 2011, where Dr. Alan Savory described his award-winning method to move carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. Download that and all our past programs from our website at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining us this week. We're going to go out with more from the international artist and founder of electronica, Ariel Kama, currently living in Australia.